Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. David Katz, founding director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center and founder of the True Health Initiative. A renowned global expert on lifestyle medicine, Dr. Katz is an internist and professor at the Yale School of Medicine, seeking to build a global consensus on lifestyle as medicine. Roy Robertson also checks in, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. David Katz, founder of the True Health Initiative, on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. David Katz, founding director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center, which is focused on the science of nutritional epidemiology, a renowned global expert on lifestyle medicine. Dr. Katz is an internist and professor at the Yale School of Medicine with a focus on preventive medicine and public health. He's also the founder of the True Health Initiative, which seeks to build a global consensus on lifestyle as medicine. Dr. Katz has published over 200 peer-reviewed articles and 16 books, including his latest, The Truth About Food, Why Pandas Eat Bamboo and People Get Bamboozled. He holds 5 U.S. patents, having invented the research method known as evidence mapping, and is the principal inventor of the overall nutritional quality index. Dr. Katz earned his M.D. from the Albert Einstein School of Medicine. Dr. Katz, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks so much, Mark. Great to be with you.
Yeah. You know, just 2 questions, you know, one on sort of on a personal side and then sort of more to what you're doing now. You're back at medical school years ago. All of your friends are going off to some ology, but you're thinking about the work in preventive medicine and public health. Love to know what the drivers were back then as you were thinking about it. And then talk to us about the obesity crisis, its true impact it's having on the health, our health and the health system.
You know, they're closely related questions, really, Mark. I think ultimately we all do the best work and are most gratified if we satisfy the native inclinations of the way we feel things, the way we see things, the way we process information. I tend to be a big picture person. So when I did my training in internal medicine, I was spending the expected 100-plus hours in the hospital taking care of desperately sick people. And, of course, it's a privilege to be a clinician and to be there in those moments of acute need. But I think I saw what many of my colleagues didn't see, and that was the pattern, the view from altitude. What I noticed was that so many of those people who were desperately sick, despite our best efforts, were never going to be truly well. Mm-hmm. And that most of them had stuff that didn't need to happen in the first place, consequences of exposure to tobacco or poor diets and atherosclerosis or lack of physical activity or you know, some behavioral mistakes leading to sexually transmitted diseases at times. But most hospital beds were filled by people who never needed to get that sick. But to prevent that from happening, you kind of needed to go back 10 years in time. So I thought, well, you know, it's too late for the current crop in the hospital, but what about their kids? And what can I do about the next cohort? And so I decided after training in internal medicine to train in preventive medicine. I still wanted the privilege of taking care of patients, which I did for 25 years, but I really wanted to do something about preventing that severe illness in the first place. You know, it's interesting, Mark. I've long thought of the great prowess of modern medicine, and it truly is impressive, as being a bit like all the king's horses and all the king's men. We can never really put health back together again. We can delay death, we can treat disease, but we're not really very good at restoring vitality once it's lost. We cannot unscramble an egg. So, you know, for that, you really do need to prevent the mayhem in the first place. So that's why I focused there. And then at the time, we go back the better part of 30 years, the obesity epidemic really was the great imperative of modern public health, as it remains today, because obesity is on the causal pathway to every major chronic disease that plagues modern societies: heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, dementia, degenerative arthritis, and on it goes. So if you're going to focus on one thing that you could potentially fix in order to prevent not just one kind of bad outcome, but almost all of the bad outcomes that plague modern societies, it would be the obesity epidemic. And I really wanted to contribute all I could to reversing those trends.
Well, we've followed your work for a long time and really appreciate the intense focus that you've had in this area. And we recognize we're up against a lot, I think, in healthcare in addressing the obesity epidemic. We have too many people probably within the healthcare community as well that see it as a personal failing. You know, if you just didn't have so many calories in or you had more calories out, we wouldn't have this problem. We counsel perhaps too often without really relying on our science base. But you've noticed there are many factors at play. Certainly, the healthcare system hasn't done all that it can do. But we also have the issue of food production and marketing and the way the industry profits from things, which are not always really in the best interest of people's health. Nice way to say it.
Yeah.
Can you help us understand what you've really developed as a lifestyle medicine approach to nutrition and disease prevention? And really, more than nutrition and disease prevention, it's really a lifestyle medicine approach to health before we have to be put together again, as you so well described it.
Thank you, Margaret. So, you know, I'm a past president of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, and I think probably my signature contribution during my 2.5 years of presidency was to say, much of our focus as a college of health professionals is on what I think we should be calling lifestyle in medicine, and that's basically better methods of interacting with patients in clinics, in hospitals, essentially in the healthcare system, to convey good information about using physical activity to promote health, prevent, and reverse disease, using dietary practices to promote health, prevent, and reverse disease, using sleep patterns to promote health, prevent, and reverse disease, managing stress, cultivating strong social interactions, avoiding toxins like tobacco, and drawing on the science of behavior modification and ways of essentially empowering our patients with options that they actually can get the medicine of lifestyle to go down. But I said, you know, I really think we're going to accomplish relatively little if we limit the solution to a cultural problem to the clinical setting. So in addition to lifestyle in medicine, we all need to be advocates of lifestyle as medicine. And consider the fact that with regard to diet, as you say, and you put it kindly, Margaret, but we've got, you know, essentially a vast, huge industry that profits from making people fat and sick. The foods with the highest profit margins are junk foods. We have been told, and more than once, frankly, in very high-profile venues like, for example, New York Times Magazine cover story, and in this instance written by a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, Michael Moss, that the entire U.S. food supply is booby-trapped to be something very much like addictive and to maximize the calories people eat before they feel full. And, you know, in fact, the food industry has practically told us that when you know, we had Lay's potato chip ads saying, "Bet you can't eat just one." Essentially, they were saying, and they meant it, we've had food engineers designing this so that, you know, you can't stop eating this stuff until your arm gets tired from lifting it to your mouth. So in that story that Michael Moss wrote, entitled The Extraordinary Science of Addictive Junk Food, basically describes how all the major food companies hire teams of PhDs, give them functional MRI machines and marching orders to design food people can't stop eating. And then, you know, we in the clinical setting are giving advice about eating better and portion control. And, well, you know, I mean, that's just not a fair fight. You've got the average busy parent who's getting 10 minutes of clinical counseling, and then she goes out into a food supply that has been designed by highly paid executives and scientists who basically get a bonus if they can figure out how to make food she and her kids cannot control, cannot stop eating. So, you know, we clearly need to make people aware of that problem. Frankly, there needs to be some collective outrage. We need to acknowledge that this is not a failure at the level of personal responsibility, that there has to be some public accountability for the nature of the food supply. We need the options that are available to us to be good options. Ultimately, Margaret, I think it's fair to note that the choices people make are subordinate to the choices people have.
Mm-hmm.
And so as president of the college, my view was lifestyle in medicine is important. We have great clinical models. We can do a lot with the science of behavior change. But we really need to be agents of culture change. Mm-hmm. If lifestyle is the best of medicine, the big spoon to get that medicine to go down is the culture, mm-hmm. not just clinics.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just want to pull the thread a little on what you just said, Dr. Katz, that it's not a fair fight for patients. The food is getting them to addicted. They're becoming fat and sick. And then patients struggle with what diet one should go on. And there's so many of those diets, fad diets that are out there for the public. And you say that we need more of a consensus on what qualifies as evidence-based nutrition guidelines, and also that patients and clinicians, need some effective tools. And you've been a creator of a couple of tools that are being widely utilized. And I'm wondering if you could just talk to our listeners about your evidence mapping and the overall nutritional quality index and how they can help people sort of regain some control over the next steps that they take, either as a patient or as a clinician.
Sure. Well, let's start, Mark, with the issue of consensus. So, yes, we need more consensus, but the reality is we have it. And this is a hypothesis that I have formally tested. So my view was, although all we ever seem to talk about when somebody puts a microphone in front of us is, you know, why my view of diet is better than your view of diet, and we sound like we don't agree, there actually is massive common ground. It's just, you know, when you invite experts to opine, they tend to opine about what makes them different, their particular area of expertise. Well, you know, that tends to be in the details, where there is the most disagreement, where the least is known. We're still exploring. Experts are probing the frontier, so they tend to talk about the frontier. What they're overlooking when they make those public comments is the vast amount of common ground right behind us. So I created the True Health Initiative, a global coalition of very diverse experts and in the diet space, ranging all the way from vegan to paleo. And I've one by one asked these colleagues from 40 countries, 500 world-leading experts, would you agree that people would be better off if they ate a diet of minimally processed food, mostly vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, lentils, nuts, and seeds, and mostly drank plain water when thirsty? And then, you know, we can leave out the rest. We can agree or disagree about adding in some meat or some fish or some dairy or some eggs. But would you agree that, you know, those are the fundamentals of a healthy diet? And there's massive global consensus. So the weight of scientific evidence, basic sense, and the global consensus of experts all points in the same direction. It's just we tend not to talk nearly enough about it, and people should check out the True Health Initiative. Once you've established, Mark, where there is, then it does become a matter of developing tools to help people get there from here. So the overall Nutritional Quality Index algorithm saw daylight in a system called NUVAL. But basically, this was a system to score the overall nutritional quality of foods on a scale from 1 to 100. The higher the number, the more nutritious the food. And I think those kinds of efforts are really important because, you know, when you go shopping for a bread or a breakfast cereal or a pasta sauce or a salad dressing, those choices all add up to make a huge aggregate difference to the quality of your diet. But, you know, how do you choose? This cereal is higher in fiber but also higher in sodium. Is it a better or worse choice? This one's lower in sodium but higher in sugar. You know, if you're really trying to choose the best overall products for your family, you need a summary judgment based on science. And so we provided that in the algorithm and scored over 125,000 foods. And at its peak, this system known as NUVAL was in 2,000 supermarkets nationwide. I'm very proud of that work done with a team of leading scientists. And then you'd asked about evidence mapping. Yeah. This is more of a research tool. You know, essentially, it's a way of looking at the scientific literature and determining where there is evidence and where there is not. Very relevant, obviously, to questions of diet and health. And this is something that I've devoted much of my career to, looking at the evidence about diet. I've written 3 editions of a leading nutrition textbook, wrote an article in 2014, an annual review of public health, entitled Can We Say What Diet Is Best for Health? And then most recently just published the Truth About Food on behalf of the True Health Initiative. So looking at the overall landscape of evidence is definitely a passion for mine. And then one new tool, it's coming soon. I've actually founded a startup company. We have invented a whole new way of assessing diet and tracking diet change. It's called Diet ID. People can just Google Diet ID and they'll find our website. But essentially, we can determine your current dietary pattern, the quality of your diet measured objectively, the nutrients you're getting from diet in about 30 seconds. It's quick, it's effortless, it's even fun, as opposed to, say, a food frequency questionnaire, which will take you an hour or more and is very tedious and memory dependent. And then we can use the same tool to identify a goal diet and help navigate you from here to there. So we're very excited about the potential of this new tool. And I definitely agree with you. We need to clarify the consensus. We know where there is. And we then need to develop tools to empower people so it's not quite so hard to get there from here.
Well, Dr. Katz, that is all very fascinating. And, you know, I'm struck by the contrast between a quote that I think you have often put forward of what Michael Pollan says with his mantra, eat whole foods, not too much, mostly plants, the kind of simplicity, elegance, brevity of that. And at the same time, we have kind of on the other side of the spectrum, your latest book, which thank you so much for referencing, The Truth About Food, which is just an encyclopedic book on evidence-based nutrition guidelines framed against the backdrop of the modern food production industry. You know, the first would seem to be our daily guide for living. The second would seem to be the book is almost feels like a responsibility of everybody who's engaged in health and healthcare to really dig deep and understand this topic in its depth as you've been researching it. Tell us what drove you to write that book with all that you've been writing and all your projects. You just told us about your startup. Why this book and what were you hoping to achieve with it?
Well, thank you, Margaret. And yes, and in the book, I definitely do cite Michael Pollan's pithy wisdom, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And I specifically say, that's the truth about food. So it's seven words. So this could be a very, very short book. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Thanks for coming. But it's not a very short book. In fact, it's a 200,000-word book. It's 750 pages.
Wow.
And as I explain in the book, the truth about food is simple. The lies are extremely complicated. So what I was trying to do, and the reason I felt like I had to write this book after having written many books on nutrition already, was it just occurred to me that no matter how many times I or other experts with good intentions told people what's true and reliable about food, someone could come along tomorrow, and almost certainly will, you know, with some new theory. Either they really believe it, or they're just hucksters, and they don't even believe it, but they know they can sell it. And they'll tell us all you have to do is cut carbs or gluten or fructose, eat only kumquat standing on one leg under the light of a full moon, or, you know, whatever the latest craziness is. You know, it'll be the four gazillionth fad diet to come over the transom, but, you know, people will sign up for it. And I thought, it's not good enough to tell people what we know is true today. What we have to do is actually transmit to people how nutrition science works, how real experts around the world know the difference between what's reliable and what's not. What I want to do, and I don't think any book has ever done this, is immunize people against tomorrow's fad diet without knowing what tomorrow's fad diet mm-hmm. even will be. And the only way to do that is to lay out not just everything I know. You know, I went into a great level of detail about what's true about coffee and lectins and gluten and the keto diet and veganism and you know, pretty much everything that's under discussion and calories and saturated fat and unsaturated fat and omega-3s and all of that. So the book includes all of that. But I went into considerable detail about how do I know what I know? Why do I know something is true? How can we experts tell when something is false? How can you use this thinking so that you're not vulnerable to the predations of charlatans in the future? Because there are an awful lot of entities out there that want to cultivate confusion about diet and that profit from it. And then I go into all of that. So a lot of the book is about the lies. What are the fallacies that you know, trip people up, and who's behind them. Some people are, you know, I think misleading the public with good intentions, that they're just wrong. But there are a lot of entities that directly profit from making us fat and sick. Big food absolutely profits from making us fat and sick. Big pharma profits from treating diseases we never needed to get in the first place. Big media profit by keeping us confused about diet, so we tune into the next story. Big publishing profits from confusion about diet because there's always a new fad diet book to sell. So I wanted to lay all of that out. And people who get a copy of The Truth About Food have access to everything I know about diet, and I tried to make it as actionable as possible.
Wonderful.
We're speaking today with Dr. David Katz, founding director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center, focused in on the science of nutritional epidemiology. Dr. Katz is a leading global expert on nutrition and disease prevention and an internist and professor at the Yale School of Medicine. You know, Dr. Katz, you are a trendsetter, if you will, in promoting lifestyles as the best preventative medicine approach to improve health and wellness. And you were on a recent panel at Virgin Pulse with Deepak Chopra, offering some predictions for promoting wellness in the next year. And I wonder if you could talk with our listeners about the predictions you shared for the coming year, the predictions others that point to a growth in lifestyle medicine practices.
They're just, you know, Mark, there's so many forces that obligate us to move in this direction. The costs of business as usual are unsustainable. The healthcare, so-called healthcare sector in the United States is simply too big a chunk of the economy, and that's because it isn't really a healthcare system. It's a disease care system. We do a lot of things to make people sick, and then we spend a ton of money to treat people who have disease. So I think, you know, if there's a unifying theme among the predictions, it's the recognition that's no longer sustainable. We need to shift in the direction of promoting vitality and maintaining wellness. And, you know, drugs don't do that. Surgery doesn't do that. Lifestyle can do that. What I emphasized is a growing confluence between the imperatives of public health and the imperatives of planetary health, and the fact that we would see those two fields coming together more and more. I've given a series of talks to gatherings of thousands of colleagues in different cities at a conference called PrimeMed. These are my colleagues in primary care. You cannot really call yourself a health professional in 2018 and not be advocating for the health of the planet, our most important patient, because there are no healthy people on an uninhabitable planet. And with what's happening to the climate and with what's happening to our aquifers, the planet is in peril. And so this then becomes a mandate, I think, to everybody who flies the flag of health professional. This is a critical issue of our time. So I predict that we will see far greater involvement in the environmental space of health professionals as more and more of us recognize this is something we have to do. If we're going to protect the health of people, we have to protect the health of the only home we have, so that it's conducive to the health of people. I feel really passionately about this. I do think, you know, ultimately this requires culture-wide commitment, but I think health professionals should be at the tip of the spear. We should be leading the way to change, saying, no, this is the critical issue of our time, and we all have to rally around it.
Well, Dr. Katz, I can't tell you how happy I am to have you address that. We were just going to raise that, and I think you've spoken to it very eloquently, along with the need to integrate the education, the training, the motivation, and the encouragement of the next generation of health professionals to understand that this is truly a huge responsibility, both to the people and to the planet. We've been speaking today with Dr. David Katz, founding director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center and founder of the True Health Initiative, which seeks to build a global consensus on lifestyle as medicine. You can learn more about his work by going to truehealthinitiative.org. You can follow him on Twitter at Dr. David Katz. And, of course, check out Diet ID that Dr. Katz talked about this morning. Dr. Katz, thank you so much for your dedication, your persistence, your groundbreaking work, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
Oh, you're both very kind. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
The U.S. Census Bureau officially estimates that close to 1 million fewer people were in poverty in 2017 compared with 2016. President Donald Trump called the decline a record, but it's not. The drop in the number of people in poverty was larger in 2016, an estimated 2.5 million fewer people, and in 2015, a 3.5 million drop. The largest estimated decline was nearly 4.7 million people in 1966. Trump made his statement about poverty when he signed an executive order creating the White House Opportunity and Revitalization Council, which intends to focus on private and public investment in low-income communities. Quote, "Last year alone, we lifted 1 million Americans out of poverty, which is a record," Trump said in his December 12th remarks. There were 39.7 million people living in poverty in 2017, according to the Census Bureau's official estimate that is calculated based on the current population survey annual social and economic supplement. That's about 918,000 fewer people than the 40.6 million who were estimated to be living in poverty in 2016. But that's not a record, and the White House didn't respond when we asked for an explanation. There were at least 16 years when the estimated number in poverty declined by 1 million or more. In fact, the Census Bureau noted that the 2017 estimate, quote, was not statistically different from the number in poverty in 2016. Also, the official poverty rate, or the percentage of the U.S. population in poverty, was 12.3% in 2017. That was 0.4 percentage points lower than in 2016. But the drop in the rate was larger in the two previous years. In fact, according to estimates that date to 1959, the largest one-year decline in the poverty rate was 2.6 percentage points from 1965 to 1966. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. During the school year, some 21 million American children receive free or reduced-price lunches through their schools, often the healthiest meal these children eat during the school day. Yet, once school is out, only 10% of these children participate in the free meal programs during the summertime. And studies have shown that many of these kids tend to gain a significant amount of weight over the summer as a result. A group of researchers at the University of South Carolina sought to tackle that issue with a program they developed called the Healthy Lunchbox Challenge. They deployed the program at a number of large community-based summer day camps. And lead researcher Dr. Michael Beetz says they relied on a simple known fact about kids: they love competition.
Staffers during the first snack period would ask kids to hold up the fruits or vegetables or water that they brought, and then at the end of the week, they announced the winner of the Healthy Lunchbox Challenge for that week.
Dr. Beetz says the simple competition and group reward system created a dramatic shift in the average camper's lunchbox from chips, cookies, and sugary drinks to more fruits, vegetables, and bottled waters.
So kids are not just bringing additional fruits, vegetables, and waters, they're substituting these healthier items for the less healthful items.
The study, published in the Journal of Nutrition, Education, and Behavior, showed a dramatic shift in the kids' homemade lunches with this really simple and inexpensive incentive program. They see this as a model for summer day camps across the country, which serve some 14 million children per year, often in underserved areas. The next phase of their study will look at the actual weight and body mass index of kids in the next round of campers to calculate the impact on lowered weight gain. The Healthy Lunchbox Challenge, a simple competitive challenge and reward system designed to get kids to switch out high-fat, high-sugar, high-calorie foods from their diets in favor of healthier snacks and beverages. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.